Hi, I'm WTOP Entertainment Editor Jason Fraley, and I'm here with
Diana Jean Shemo
and
Sky Sydney,
who are running the second annual Double Exposure Investigative Film Fest on Thursday through Saturday, October 6th through 8th. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for being here.
Thank you for having us.
Now, this is only the second year of this thing, but I gotta say, you guys were like a rookie baseball player hitting a home run and his first at-bat last year, because your very first festival was with Spotlight, which went on to win Best Picture. How crazy is that? Talk about, like, is that sort of like a great feather in your cap as you're trying to get, you know, rolling out the second year?
Absolutely. Are you kidding me? We could not believe it ourselves. And Spotlight also took the best screenplay, and we had actually both the screenwriter and the director on hand last year, the original members of the Spotlight investigative team, and the actual journalists, who in a way were the stars of the show, and David Simon moderating. So it was sort of like, pinch me, is this really happening?
Yeah, and if you go on our website, we have that interview. We actually caught up with David Simon, who of course created The Wire, afterwards, and spoke with him about why. It was just interesting hearing him say that he was sitting in the theater the first time he watched Spotlight, and that very last scene, you know, the phones are ringing in the office as all the other abuse victims are calling in, and he's looking at the screen thinking to himself, like, cut to black, like, this is perfect. And Michael Keaton picks up the phone and says, Spotlight, and it cuts to black, and David Simon was like, yes, perfect.
That's right.
It was great.
That was wonderful.
I actually went out and covered the Oscars this year, and so it was interesting seeing your guys' festival here in D.C. before, like, months before it came out in theaters, and then watching the whole run to Oscars and saying those guys were right at the Investigative Fest.
That's right.
So you guys obviously know what you're doing then, picking these movies. So take me into opening night film this year.
The Ivory Game is an incredible film because it's in a way like Spotlight in the sense that it has an important story, public interest story to tell. In this case, it's about ivory poaching. The extinction of elephants in Africa and the criminal networks and the sort of Chinese legal system that has a quota that actually allows legal importation of ivory that's exploited and used to bring in tons and tons and tons. So there's a sort of important environmental story and animal wildlife protection story there. But there's also an important journalistic story nested inside this great drama. The film is officially a documentary, but it sort of plays like a thriller. It tracks a group of activists that run something called Wild Leaks, which is sort of like WikiLeaks, but for tips on wildlife poaching. And actually, 100 Reporters is a member of that group, a founding member, a starting member. I wouldn't say founding. But anyway, that group gets tips on trafficking, and it puts together teams to go after the traffickers. So in this instance, they had government investigators, the team from Wild Leaks, and also a Chinese journalist who is going to be part of the story and who's going to be with us at the festival. We, you know, managed to get him a visa, and he's going to be coming and joining us. And what happens in that story that's so interesting is they actually go after these networks to expose them, but not just to get a story. He's going after it because he wants to put an end to the trafficking. And so he's working hand in hand with prosecutors and government investigators, posing, you know, going undercover and posing as a purchaser of ivory himself, going into stores and saying, oh, this is nice, and getting the store shopkeeper to say things like, oh, you think this is great? We've got tons in our warehouse. You should come see our warehouse. All very incriminating stuff. And he tracks it actually to the triads, and it's tremendously dangerous. But he does it. And if people come, they'll hear why he did it, because it's a really fascinating and moving story how he did that.
God, that sounds powerful.
It is.
It really is.
What's the name of the filmmaker that's going to be there? You said he's going to be.
It's a co-directed film. Okay. Yes. Keith Davidson and Richard Larkani.
Oh, cool.
Are the co-directors.
Are they both going to be there, or just
they
Keith?
Are.
Oh, wow. Just talk to our listeners about how, because obviously it was cool with all the Spotlight folks last year, but talk about how it's awesome to not only be there opening night and see this powerful documentary that I'm sure is going to change everyone's view on these things, but then to hear the filmmaker talk afterwards.
Absolutely.
Just say how much of a treat that is.
That's what is unique about a festival experience over seeing a film in a theatrical setting at a movie theater or even at home, you know, on television or on a platform. We're committed to bringing the filmmakers, but beyond that, also the film subjects. And because, of course, of our mission at Double Exposure, which is looking at how films are inspired by the investigative instinct, often journalists who are covering that story or themselves have been the seed of inspiration for that story being told. So the angle is always how this film is in some ways functioning as a work of investigative journalism, And how journalists themselves are recognizing the power of visual storytelling to expand their own mission, essentially.
Yeah. That sounds like a hell of a way to open the festival.
Absolutely.
Yeah, I love it. All right, well, take me into the next night, Friday. Yeah. We have A Leak in Paradise, All Governments Lie, and Betting on Zero. Who wants to take some of those?
So A Leak in Paradise is...
Yeah, let's go one by one.
Okay. All right,
so we don't confuse the listeners.
Right. Yeah, so A Leak in Paradise is... Everybody was watching the Panama Papers investigation this year, the big investigation of hidden assets, corrupt government officials, where they hide their money, and sort of the scope and scale of this thing was astonishing, the biggest leak in history. But it actually started before that. There's a guy called Rudy Elmer, and he's profiled in A Leak in Paradise, who was a vice president at Julius Baer and who first opened his mouth about this. He was in charge of secret bank accounts in the Cayman Islands. And... just released a whole bunch of information to WikiLeaks. It prompted an unprecedented level of scrutiny into these bank accounts, and the Swiss government responded by basically going after Rudy Elmer. He ended up having to go into exile in Mauritius. He was basically hunted down. He lost all of his friends. And so this story is sort of about this world of hidden money and how well protected it is. You know, the Justice Department went on to try to prosecute and get information and change the laws. But at the core of this, at the start of this, was a work of investigative journalism and a whistleblower. And that's the first feature that we're going to be showing. Rudy's going to be there along with the director, David Lulu.
All right. What about the other movie that day, All Governments Lie? So interesting title.
Yes,
on a book, and the author of the book on which it's based will be there as well, Myra McPherson.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And so what is this about?
So this is about I.F. Stone, who, if you were born after 1975, you probably heard about him as a sort of legendary figure. But if you were a dinosaur like me, you would actually, you know, maybe know him or have read him. I.F. Stone is sort of the grandfather of investigative journalism. You know, he worked here in Washington, Northwest, out of his house. Well, I'm not sure if it was out of his house. I know he did some of it out of his house. But anyway... he was a kind of a journalist. He didn't go to the noonday briefings at the White House or the State Department. They wouldn't have him. But what he did instead was he actually went through everything that government produced. He would go through the records and he would look. His operating assumption was all governments lie, and it was his job to figure out just how and where the lie was. And he did it day in and day out for decades. And he became a real model, you know, and he kind of shaped the way we think of investigative journalism as something that is not about opinion. It's not about who speaks loudest. It's about what does the evidence show you and a fair-minded reading of it. And so he never tried to become a crony. He never tried to go to like the, you know, fancy dinners or to have lunch. He really was a guy who was dedicated to serving the public interest. So this movie is great. It looks at his legacy, and then it kind of looks at who now is operating in his spirit, and it identifies...
Who's carrying the baton these days.
Exactly. Yeah. Like, who's doing it now? And so, you know, it identifies a handful of journalists. Some of them are, you know, straightforward.
Who are some of them? Do you remember?
Jeremy Scahill, Matt Tybee,
Amy Goodman
is in there. He talks a little to Glenn Greenwald.
Dan Frumkin.
Who is going to be attending. So... he, you know, identifies these people and then sort of profiles them as the people who are sort of carrying the torch in a way.
So in addition to Dan Frumkin, who we mentioned, who's the Washington Bureau, I think that's his...
Washington editor for The Intercept.
I'll say it one more time. Washington editor for The Intercept. As previously mentioned, Myra McPherson, who wrote the original book, All Governments Lie, as well as I.F. Stone's grandson, Peter Stone, who's a... very respected investigative journalist in his own right. So they'll be there along with, of course, the filmmaker and producer, Fred Peabody and Peter Raymond, who are very distinguished in the filmmaking community.
See, already with just these like three movies, this is not like just going to the movies.
Oh, no.
You're going to get to meet all these great, important people.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Awesome. All right, also that night, the third one Friday, Betting on Zero.
Oh,
who wants to take that?
We love this film, too. We just love this film because it's a delicious film. I mean, it's...
What makes it so delicious? What's this about?
Betting on Zero is about Bill Ackman, who is the manager of Pershing Capital, giant hedge fund, like one of the leading hedge funds. And he poses a very interesting question. He asks, can Wall Street be used as a force for morality? what he does is he takes $1 billion short position on Herbalife, you know, the company that has all of these sort of products that are supposed to be healthy. And what he says is, look at their own materials. This is really not, they're not about selling products to people. This is a Ponzi scheme. It's an illegal pyramid scheme. And if Wall Street knew the full extent of what's going on, people would stop investing. So he goes, he takes his $1 billion short position and goes on the attack and just makes a full frontal assault on this company and on its business practices. And
so if anyone saw The Big Short, they'll kind of get the idea of what this short.
They'll understand how to follow this story. I mean, actually, you don't need, this is a very like accessible drama. It's not like, you know, The Big Short had a very interesting way of presenting complex ideas about derivatives and, you know, how mortgages are bundled and sold as securities and all that. This is not that difficult. This is really like, and you know, anybody who's read the stories about Bernie Madoff, about, you know, any number of these sort of multi-level marketing schemes understands that, you know, what a pyramid scheme is. So people, they become distributors. They find they have to invest $3,000 in product. They can't move the product. It molds up, you know, in their garages. The only way they can redeem their investment is to bring other people on, other suckers on, right, in a way. And so some people make that choice, and some people stop and say, no, I won't do this. But he wanted to see Washington, you know, go after them. And, you know, in the end, what happens is you follow this story and see that, in fact, the Latino community is particularly targeted and has really borne some incredible hardship through this. So I should say we invited Herbalife to come, and they opted not to, so they won't be there for the post-screening. But we have on hand, we're going to have, so this short position that he took began with reporting by Christine Richard, who is a financial reporter, so she'll be there. And Bill Ackman himself will be there. Yeah. The director will be there. A woman in Chicago, who Julie Contreras, who got involved with trying to kind of call out Herbalife for what was happening in the Latino community, and Ricardo Sandoval Palos from, well, he's not with NPR now, but he was with NPR. He's going to be moderating. So we have a really amazing panel, and in the audience we will have a man who whose life was really, he contends, severely damaged by his involvement with Herbalife. So that's, I think, going to be really fascinating. We can see that we have great interest in it already because ticket sales are very strong for that. And so we're anticipating it's going to be a really fascinating evening, and we're excited. We're just like thoroughly excited to have this film.
Oh, that's awesome. Yeah. And that's just the first two days.
I know, right?
Man, all right. Let's move into Saturday's movies now. So you want to start with Fire at Sea?
Absolutely. So this film won a very prestigious award at its premiere in Berlin, and has been really critically acclaimed. It's a somewhat poetic, if not lyrical, exploration of a tiny little Sicilian, an island off of Sicily that also is fairly near Tunisia.
Okay.
Which happens to be on the exact trajectory of many boats filled with people seeking refuge on their way to Europe, passing by the Sicilian waters, who tragically don't make it. We see this happening in the headlines all the time, you know, boats packed to the rafters with people that are overturning, etc. So it really focuses on the impact on this island, where you see the very quiet day-to-day quotidian experiences of the people on this living their lives in Sicily while this literal global crisis is washing up on their shores. Mm-hmm. In some cases, the local doctors take action and try by any means necessary to offer comfort, support, but it's infinitely beyond anyone's capacity to handle. So it's looking at this quiet little fishing town that happens to be the most unexpected backdrop for one of the greatest tragedies unfolding in our day. So it's a very poignant look at that. And kind of quietly explore something that is incredibly stark and powerful.
Wow. And who's, is there going to be filmmakers?
In this case, we have a journalist from the New York Times, Ron Nixon, and
Kathleen Newland, who's from Immigration Policy Institute. And we're actually reaching out to human rights organizations to see if there are a few people that we've reached out to, so we haven't really heard yet on whether they're going to be able to join us. But
okay, but it sounds like right a great now. Film. Regardless,
yeah, I mean, it's a very powerful and very important film, and it's also a work of extraordinarily accomplished filmmaking. You know, so at the end of the day, this festival celebrates not only the power of the stories that have significance, but also the craft in which they're told.
Yeah.
And this is, you know, certainly one that's got a very distinct cinematic craft.
Yeah. Also on Saturday.
Yep.
Sour grapes.
This is probably one of our, you know, here we have topics that are very heavy and intense. This is incredibly enjoyable. It's essentially about this quite quirky young man who managed to infiltrate the world of fine wine and managed to create fake Burgundies and infiltrate the marketplace, selling them for thousands upon thousands of dollars and having them entered into some of the most rarefied collections. And the film, from the get-go, you know that he's a fraud. So that is not the question. The question is, how on earth did this person manage to fool so many people? What was his process? So it's an incredibly, truly edge of your seat experience and takes you into the world of fine wine. And you don't have to, I think, even appreciate wine to appreciate this story, because it's all about how someone is able to pull off such a massive con.
Yeah.
And, you know, fool people who are proud of their delicate palate to believing that this blend of, you know, Manischewitz essentially is, is a wonderful Burgundy from 1942.
And he fools them.
He fools everybody until he doesn't.
Right.
There's a moment where people become suspicious, just things don't add up.
Mm.
But from a palate perspective, most people don't recognize, you know, that this is not authentic, which the major distributors in the Burgundy region are deeply concerned about. And that's part of what motivates this investigation, as well as that of a particular collector, Bill Koch, who also becomes suspicious, not because of the taste necessarily. Sometimes he doesn't even drink it. These are to be saved, but because of something suspicious about the labels.
Sometimes it's like a historical thing. Like there were five bottles that supposedly Thomas Jefferson had touched that he paid $100,000 each for.
Just because TJ touched him.
Supposedly Thomas Jefferson.
And then it's learned, discovered, and I'm not sure if it's exactly that case, but discovered this particular vintage wasn't produced in that year. You know, something happens.
The wine bottle.
Right.
This is like Hitchcock
really
Notorious.
Fun. It's really,
the wine bottles.
It's the kind of film that you just can't, truly, utterly engrossing.
You want popcorn for this film, right?
You want popcorn
for this
absolutely.
Film.
And absolutely.
The thing I also loved about this film was that there are some people who were so duped that even when it was, the gig was up, they still continue to believe.
I
want to believe
this. Yes.
Like, they still like, no, I still believe.
So who's going to be the filmmaker? Who's coming?
Well, we have actually in this case a woman who's featured in the film, who was one of the investigative journalists who began to recognize, who started taking on the case and had written about it. She's considered wine expert, Maureen Downey. And then also from the Washington Post.
Manuel Roig Francia, whose family actually has a vineyard and, sells wine, and he knows wine and he writes. So we have a
food and wine critic of acclaim.
Wow.
It's hard to get the subject to want to appear in, association with the film,
right.
Although I think he might be incarcerated.
I don't think he has much of a choice.
Exactly.
Yeah, you're coming. You should have him stand on stage and do the I Love Lucy stomping on the grapes while he answers the
questions.
Right.
It's actually a great segue into the next film about incarceration, which if you want to take...
Oh, well, that's Solitary.
Solitary, the other Saturday movie.
Yeah, Solitary is... Yeah, so Solitary is sort of the other end of the spectrum because it's, it's about Red Onion State Prison in Southern Virginia, which is a supermax facility. And it's really about, the rise of supermax facilities and what it's like on a very intimate basis. Here the filmmaker spent essentially a year watching this prison and sort of filming it. Initially, As I understand, initially the administrators of the prison, the warden and the others, thought that they were doing something good, and so they were happy to have her come in and film. But as she filmed, you know, what emerged was quite a different story, and it's the story of people who are kept in prison indefinitely, in solitary confinement, without any judicial review or outside oversight, and what it does to their spirit. And this is something that is considered torture. In most of the world, solitary confinement is considered torture. And in the U.S. prison system, this sort of has risen in the last, since 1984, I believe, this has become kind of the place where, you know, prisons put people who are just discipline problems, and they can languish. And there's one guy who's been in solitary confinement since 1984.
Wow.
And Pete Early, who's going to be on hand for this discussion, is in contact with him. So it's just a really kind of, I think it's a tragic thing that's developed in the prison system. And this film is going to give people who never have a chance or a reason to see the inside of a prison a very intimate look at its dark underside, mm-hmm. If you can say that. I mean, prison by definition is probably all dark underside, but this is really, you know, sort of an overlooked thing that's kind of developed and really should kind of work at everybody's conscience.
Absolutely. And so the filmmaker Christy Jacobson will be there, and the aforementioned Pete Early, who wrote a book, The Hot House, Inside Leavenworth Prison, will also be on hand, moderated by a journalist, Lisa Armstrong.
Oh, wow. Man, you guys have a lineup.
And we have one final film.
Yes, there's a closing night,
exactly,
right?
Exactly, our closing night film. And so this is a film quite dear to my heart because my own background and years spent in documentary film, I admire to no end the filmmaker Steve James, who made the iconic film Hoop Dreams and an extraordinary film, Life Itself, which was on the life. And
Roger Ebert.
Roger Ebert, exactly.
We actually, at AFI Docs, we had Life Itself, and I moderated a panel with Steve James and one of Ebert's childhood friends for the opening or closing night of AFI Docs, last year.
Right, that's wonderful.
So Steve is awesome, he's going to be there.
Absolutely. Oh, wow. He's a terrific filmmaker, and he's, you know, deeply empathetic, both in person and through his film, and you can feel that intimacy that he develops with his subjects. So this is a film called Abacus, Small Enough to Jail, which will resonate with this idea of too big to fail, and that's intentional. It follows the only bank that was actually indicted during the 2008 financial crisis.
This happens. Hard to think, there's only one, right?
There's only one. And what is this one? A tiny mom and pop operation in Chinatown, New York City.
None of the big guys.
None of the big guys. A tiny little mom and pop shop run by first-generation Chinese parents with their second-generation Chinese-American children. So the Sung family, who runs Abacus Bank, was embroiled in a five-year battle, costing thousands and thousands of dollars and losing a great deal of faith in the community in which they had been a great and vibrant neighbor for many, many years. So you see the impact of that on their personal lives and on their professional existence. And I don't quite want to give it away, but let's just say that it really looks at the question of the justice system and racism within that, and you know how one is being scapegoated. But it's a very powerful film where you're really given an opportunity to intimately watch the impact of this on a family and on a community, and who's targeted and who's left unscathed.
So the Small Enough to Jail is a play on Too Big to Fail. I love it. Yeah. He's an amazing filmmaker.
Yeah.
And what was the one, I can't believe I'm blanking on it. What was the one where he brings classic movies to an island?
Well, Real Paradise.
Real Paradise.
Right.
I love that movie.
Yeah, it's wonderful.
And they're like showing them Apocalypse Now, Redux and all that. It was a great documentary.
Absolutely. Wonderful.
Oh, so I'm so excited to see this one.
Good.
And you said he's going to be there?
Oh, he's going to be there. One of the members of the Sung family. Two key journalists who followed the story, and
Jacoby, I think.
Yes, and then are moderated by a producer from Frontline, James Jacoby. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So it's going to be a really moving experience, and I think a deep discussion.
Awesome. Take me some. We've gone a lot into the movies, and they sound great. But what are some of the particulars in terms of what venue are we at? The Portrait Gallery again,
or? Mm-hmm. Yeah, so the National Portrait
Gallery.
That's right. So big
every
theater.
Night is the Portrait Gallery.
Yeah, so that's our exclusive home for films. What's distinct about Double Exposure, and in some ways it's inherent in the name, not only looking at the double of the filmmaker and journalist, but it's actually a double program. That is, double exposure encompasses both a film program, but also a concurrent symposium, largely targeted towards professional filmmakers and journalists. So over the course of the three-day festival, two of those days also have daytime panels, masterclasses, workshops taking place at the National Press Club, where we really unpack some of these issues and look, take a magnifying glass on the most important stories of our day and how various journalists and filmmakers are approaching them through their distinct and often similar kinds of methods.
And I'm trying to remember, not only is the Portrait Gallery just a beautiful venue to do this, but they also have that little that courtyard, right? Are you guys going to have the little, you know, hors d'oeuvres and wine kind of a thing like last year?
Yeah, we are doing that, but we're doing it across the street at NOPA.
Okay.
We felt like last year we had a great time and it was a beautiful gala, but we wanted to change the vibe a little bit this year, so we're doing it at NOPA across the street, which is just catty corner, very close.
And when is this the opening night?
Yeah.
Or is this
I think the other thing we should probably mention is that last year, opening night was solely by invitation only. And this year, people can buy tickets for it. We've set aside a certain block of tickets for people who want to attend, and they can choose to attend either the screening or the screening and the after the party afterward.
How do they buy tickets, and how much is it?
It's $15 to attend just the screening, and it's $75 to attend the screening and the party, the reception after. And they buy tickets by going to the website, which is www.doubleexposurefestival.com.
Awesome. We'll link to it on the web page too, the article. So the $15, is the same go for all the movies?
Yes.
The individual price?
That's
okay.
Right.
That's not too bad. That's just
tickets.
Like a regular movie.
Right, exactly.
You know, if we have a news junkie, so we're thinking about this internally as like news junkie meet film junkie. So if we have, you know, if somebody feels like that's them, they can also buy a pass, which will give them access to all of the films, all eight films for $75.
Oh, that's a steal.
It's a steal.
Because if you see enough movies, that more than pays for itself.
That's right.
Plus,
yeah.
I mean, all right, if you're going to drop that much, you're going to drop $15 going to the multiplex, but this, you're getting to meet the filmmaker
Absolutely.
Too. Like, so that's, I mean, that's more than worth.
Yeah, this is food for your mind.
That's right.
Whoa. Food for your mind.
Yes.
That just blew my mind. Okay, cool. So, and it's metro accessible, so you have no excuse. Get down there, just right off the Chinatown stop, right?
That's
the Press
right.
Club is right by
exactly.
Metro Center.
That's right.
Awesome. Well, before you go, I just kind of want to know, since now we're in the second year, you know, I'm sure you guys are swamped and stressed because I know how festivals can be, right? But what is it, compared to last year, like what did you sort of learn off of last year? Was there any, you know, sort of first year challenges that you had to overcome and you know, have made it easier for year two?
We're still learning.
We can't
wait almost for year three to apply everything we're learning right now to that. But, you know, we're lucky to have a consistent partners and consistent team. You know, getting to work with some of these venues again for the second time and, you know, have that institutional knowledge and history from prior years. And I think one thing that's really great in having a second year, and we hope there are many more beyond that, is building our name. And I'm seeing that audiences in DC, journalists and filmmakers are beginning to know us. And I think that will only help us as we continue over time having that brand.
Yeah, and I think also, you know, when we started out last year, we were just kind of identifying, you know, this kind of film, this new kind of film. And what we've seen since last year, which has been, we can't take credit for it, but what we see and are thrilled by is a real kind of continuing growth in the quality and the kinds of films that are coming out. And so, you know, we see just artists and journalists sort of pushing the boundaries in such interesting ways. So I think that's been one thing that we're so kind of gratified, because it's not just about us, we're putting on a festival or we're putting on a symposium. It's really about like the work itself. And the work itself is dictating the need for this. There's a reason why when we reach out to foundations, they're jumping on this very quickly. I've been, you know, working in the journalism field for a number of years, and, you know, this idea is something that it has power and it's moving forward because it's responding to a need that's out there and just such an interesting array of work that's coming out. So I think we see ourselves going forward as being part of that movement, as being, you know, a place that journalists will come, and as they are sort of making this transition and, you know, everybody is looking to how do we keep an audience? We're doing important work. How do we find our audience? How do we keep it? How do we engage them? To do that, they're moving more and more into the visual realm. And we want, you know, we want to be the place where they know they're working on an interesting story and they're trying to find, like, would this make a good movie? This is the place they should come, because that's where they're going to meet the person and have that discussion. And the other way, too, for the filmmaker who says, like, you know, I'm looking into this issue. I wonder if there's, if it's a quirk that I found this guy who's in this situation, or if it's part of something bigger.
Right.
This is the place they'll find a journalist and talk to and say, well, can we look into this and see if there's actually a story here, or just, you know, a single person tale.
Love it. You mentioned that you'd spent years working in journalism before this festival. Tell me sort of a little bit about, I mean, briefly, but each of your guys' sort of background and what brought you to start this thing last year.
Okay. Well, I have been a journalist for almost 30 years now, and I was 9 years at the Baltimore Sun. I was their first female foreign correspondent, you know, to head a foreign bureau. I was sent Paris at the age of 29. So the Baltimore Sun actually had foreign bureau since 1922, and it wasn't until 87 that they finally sent a woman, and that was me.
Wow.
Anyway, I was there for 9 years, and then I was recruited by the New York Times. I worked there 17 years. I wrote for every desk except sports, and I was their bureau chief in Latin America for 4 years. I was based in Brazil, and I covered the drug war in Colombia, the rise of Hugo Chavez in Brazil, in Venezuela, Ecuador, Paraguay trafficking, and Paraguay is a swamp in some ways, but anyway. and I did some reporting on Peru during a particular moment of crisis there. So I went to Somalia for the New York Times. It was a great time there, and I left in 2008 to write a book. That came out in 2010. It's called Skies to Conquer. It's a year inside the Air Force Academy, which has been quite a home for scandal, but other things too. I mean, what I found looking at it was there was good things too.
And Skies then, to Conquer.
Yeah. We never made that connection somehow.
Amazing.
It's the perfect segue.
Take it away, Skies.
Well, speaking of Skies to Conquer, how'd she conquer you?
Right. Well, I think the part where we just left off with Diana creating a wonderful organization, 100 Reporters.
Yes.
And it was, you know, under that umbrella that the idea of this festival came on board. And I became the film side of the equation, the yin to the yang.
So we got the journalist and
exactly,
the filmmaker.
Yeah, exactly. So that double exposure also is kind of the double of our two areas of expertise.
Right.
And for me, you know, film has in many ways been a part of my life, even from the day I was born. My family, my father in particular, is a film scholar, and I just grew up surrounded by filmmakers, particularly very independent filmmakers, if not avant-garde filmmakers, and as an adult knew that that's what I wanted to do myself. So my professional career has largely been that of a curator, had been a programmer for a number of different festivals before I moved to D.C. to become first the director of programming of what was called Silver Docs, and then quickly became the festival director. And the festival itself also morphed into AFI Docs, but essentially had been in that position between that director of programming to festival director for almost 10 years, and really became deeply invested and committed to documentary. And since leaving my post there, I've been teaching at Georgetown University in film and media studies.
Nice.
And doing a lot of interesting projects, but none more interesting than my work as co-director of Double Exposure, which is kind of marrying all these interests in a really exciting new way for me personally. So I see this as a major new chapter in my life.
I love it. We got the two sides here coming together for Double Exposure. I love it.
Could I take 1 second just to kind of talk about 100 Reporters, what it is? Because I realized that I was remiss when we went into this.
And we're coming up on an anniversary, right?
We are. It's about to turn 5. And, and
it can walk now.
It can walk. Right, and it can even talk.
Yeah.
So 100 Reporters is actually, it's an organization that brings together 100 reporters from around the world, investigative reporters. And what we do is both deep dive investigations into pressing issues of public concern, And we also work with emerging journalists in the developing world, where there may not be a long tradition of investigative reporting or even an independent press. And we work with them, we mentor them, we publish their work, and we basically are trying to kind of connect them with the international kind of platform so that the stories that only they can tell get out there. I spent, as I mentioned earlier, I spent 9 years as a foreign correspondent for major American papers. And you can do great work that way. But one thing that happens is when the paper says, we're going to close that bureau, as the Baltimore Sun had to do in the 1990s, they closed a whole slew of bureaus. Mm. When they close their bureaus, that oversight, to the extent that it even matters, leaves. And the people who are left on the ground after that may not even have a tradition of independent journalism or accountability. Right. They don't have laws to allow it. They don't have contacts and friends on the outside to publish work elsewhere. The internet has opened up a whole new possibility since the 1990s. It's all opened up tremendous possibilities for bridging that distance. So it doesn't really matter anymore if the local press is, you know, dependent on government advertising and won't permit the story to be told. You can connect with an outlet outside of the country and just vault that barrier.
So while the bureaus are closing down, another opportunity was coming right around the same time. So
exactly.
Fortunately,
I mean, journalism famously is lacking a business model, and we all know that, and we all sort of suffer through that. But the important thing is that there are people who want to hold their governments accountable, and they need to connect with the outside world, and that's what we try to do. So 100 Reporters is very, very proud of its work in doing this. We work with journalists in Africa. We work with them in the Middle East, and we basically work with them to get their stories in shape for publication and on our platform and in other media. So this is, you know, Foreign Policy Online has published our work, New York Times, Washington Post, and that's really, you know, where we feel like we make a big difference. Other than that, we do, you know, just good investigative reporting that, you know, we all do here. But that's the thing that we do that's really unique, and it's a common thread in a sense, because we have, like, with Double Exposure, with the Investigative Film Festival, we're pushing boundaries artistically. We're exploring the work that is pushing boundaries artistically and saying to everybody, look, you know, look what great work investigative journalism is about these days. And there we are also pushing boundaries and saying, let's not let, you know, the business model of journalism dictate accountability for all of these citizens around the world. And, you know, that's kind of where we find ourselves. I wanted to just end with one thought, which was my daughter, who is 11 years old, was like looking at some of like our Facebook page and everything. And you know, I'm sort of like an inside baseball person sometimes, like I get in the weeds too much. And she looked at it and, you know, she was quiet. She disappeared in her room. And then she came to me like a half an hour later and she said, look, mommy, I made you a new page. And I looked at it and she created this hashtag that really sums up what this is all about. And she called it, I love journalism.
Whoa.
That's wonderful.
Sometimes you need the, you know, outside, almost innocent of youth to boil it down, right?
Exactly.
Well, happy fifth birthday to 100 Reporters and happy second birthday to the Double Exposure Festival. This is awesome.
Thank you, Jason.
Thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you so much.
Last point, if they've heard this, it sounds awesome. What gets them there? Why should they come out?
Have an opportunity to encounter the most important stories of our day made by brilliant filmmakers and journalists, where the stories come alive on screen and then get to meet the people behind those stories in person.
Yeah, so I think if you're a thinking person who cares about public affairs and public issues, you'll want to be there. You have to be there, in fact.
You must be there.
You must be there.
And see the next spotlight. What's going to win this year?
Exactly.
You never know. All right, thanks so much, guys. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
Wonderful.